Probably the most single important thing when we look back at Jewish history of close to 6,000 years as counted in the Jewish manner. And I say close to 6,000 years because it's 5,800 and something, and I'm not 100% certain, so 6,000 gives me a bit of leeway. Is there are three central tenets. There's the tenet of land, of people, and of Torah. So Torah meaning the law, the whole body of Jewish knowledge that is based on the Bible. So that's one part of the triangle. The second is the people of Israel, and the third is the land of Israel. And let us not get confused with the political state called Israel today. We're talking about the spiritual and the homeland of Israel as it was determined way back at the beginning of history. If that's the only thing you take away from me here today, that those three tenets, it is through that lens that we get an understanding of everything Jewish and indeed environmentalism. Because the Jewish people were banished from the land of Israel many, many moons ago, the central relationship of that triangle by definition was not land-based. And indeed, all of the law that was suggested that you would work around land-based things were not able to be done. So central Jewish concepts like Shemitah. Shemitah is the seventh year of leaving the fields fallow. Or the Yovel, the 50th year in which it is the Jubilee. Now, those concepts, those are Hebrew concepts which today make sense ecologically and biodynamically around agriculture. They're ancient concepts. And yet, for the people of Israel, they were not able to be done because when Jews were banished from the land of Israel, they were not allowed to own land or were not allowed to be farmers. And that is part of the history, the lens of Jewish history. And so if we look back through that lens, the primary relationship becomes about the people and the law. The law in all of its manifestations, which today leads many people to think of the better Jews or the more religious Jews are the ones who are still stuck back in the garb of Poland and Eastern Europe with their black hats and their black smocks and their curled hair ringlets. So that kind of thing is, that's the law, that's the relationship between the people and the law. And that has been so for a lot of years now. Only with the establishment of the State of Israel and the aspirations that we were becoming an unnatural people because we had no land, has that slightly started to be readjusted. And it's interesting, of course, to note here in Australia, in particular where we live, is that the sense of land is so powerful in the Indigenous story that it's almost impossible to imagine it without it. And yet the Jewish people have had to survive without that central tenet. And so it's not a long leap of imagination to imagine that the law and the ritual becomes the bedrock which holds two sides of the triangle together. So, of course, we all know the Genesis story to some degree. And the Genesis story has got two stories about the environment and two different words, two different concepts. In the first chapter of Genesis, it says, "Be fruitful and multiply." This is God speaking to the humans. "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish and subdue." Gosh, in today's language, if we asked anybody to subdue somebody, it would be a call to dox or something like that. And you're not allowed to subdue things. In fact, we want to do the opposite, don't we? The other, only one chapter later, in Genesis 2, verse 15, God placed man in the Garden of Eden to cultivate and guard. Very different concepts, yeah? Replenish and subdue, or cultivate and guard. And remember the lens? Yeah, remember the lens? A lot of thought was given about what this means. And a lot of interpretation on how are these two things seemingly coherent when they appear as incoherent. And the explanation I love the best is from a rabbi called Joseph Soloveitchik. And he says that the Bible as written, whether or not by God, if you believe that, or whether or not by story told, inspired by God, which is more what I believe, is that these two aspects are the two aspects of humanity with relationship to that environment. And I thought to myself, how succinct it is to capture that the two almost polar opposites are to cultivate and guard as opposed to replenish and subdue. And when you hold that as a concept, it really makes a bit more sense as to why the world looks like it does. We've been given two imperatives and been left to ourselves to make the best judgment. And I love that thought. I love that thought that the individual or the way we come together as a community, we actually have the power to either subdue or to cultivate and guard. And really, I think that's a very powerful message for us today, is that a lot of what can happen is also our responsibility and within our power to enact change or to enact continuity, either way. In doing some research for this talk, I was inspired by another Jewish concept. Again, remember the lens, we'll see this through the lens. Tikkun Olam. Tikkun Olam means repairing the world. And there's a fantastic Kabbalistic spiritual story that goes something like this. God was looking for a way to ensure that humans would be partners in this work of creation. So, of course, God, in the sense of God's unknowingness and the incapacity of us to conceptualize, God itself breaks itself into a whole bunch of shards of light, and they get kind of spread through the world. And when God calls them back in, not all of the shards come back. And the shards of light that are still in and amongst us, and the quest to find those shards and create the wholeness of God, that is part of the quest of Tikkun Olam. That is part of the quest of repairing the world. Now sit with me for a moment and imagine me telling you this story when the Cossacks are beating down on the doors to enact another atrocity on the Jewish people in Eastern Europe. Or imagine me trying to explain this to you when the Jewish people of Eastern Europe in particular were not allowed to own any land. We're not allowed to farm, we're not allowed to own land, we're not allowed to do guild jobs that were in guilds. It's a bit hard kind of grasping this esoteric concept of fixing the world when your very sense of purpose and very sense of presence is in peril. So if we go back to that lens, it's not hard for me to say, or it's not hard for me to suggest, why until very recently it would seem as though there is an absence of understanding within the Jewish religion and people in their practice and behavior that environmentalism is an important thing. Yeah? The thread that I'm trying to develop here is that until recently, the concept of Tikkun Olam and fixing the world from a Jewish perspective was much more about things that were related and relevant to the Jewish history and the Jewish people's experience. So who were at the forefront of the American Civil Rights Movement, apart from those black Americans themselves? They were Jewish people. who was at the forefront of the South African push for one person, one vote, one man, one vote, one person, one vote. That South African experience of history, the white South African experience of history through those years, is littered with Jewish names, alongside the Africans who were seeking independence and the quality of one person, one vote. But it would appear on the surface that environmentalism and that sense of that eco-relationship is kind of almost not present. And yet, when I take a deeper view and a longer view of that lens, is that there are some very strong tenets, as I related to them earlier, in the Bible, and a lot of commentary about what those things mean that could instruct us as Jewish folk today, and see it not only through the sense of the form, like, you know, the form, which we may see a little video a little later, or the rallying around no plastic bags, or the rallying around in some synagogues are being built in the US in particular as carbon neutral. It's easier to see those things with form than to really capture this idea of spirit, that there's something much greater in our relationship with the environment than plastic bags and a carbon neutral. And I suspect that that dialogue, that continuum between form and spirit, is probably the thing that resonates for all of us who believe that spirit has a place in our life, and how we work with that sense of spirit and form. And it's no wonder the world outside looks like it does, because we have been so focused and humanity has been so driven by form for so long that it almost feels like spirit in some places has been extinguished. And in that sense, Judaism is not different to any of the other major world religions which are struggling to find the relevance of spirit in everyday life. If I was to sum up, which we already acknowledge is almost impossible, is that Judaism has a strong basis for environmentalism. And even the word eco-faith is a beautiful blend between spirit and form. So the eco speaks to us here about what that could look like, and the faith speaks about what it feels like. And it's an absolute masterful stroke to call it those two things. And Judaism has the opportunity both on a formed legal plane, so the laws of kosher, of how you should eat, the laws of supposedly washing your hands before every meal and saying grace after every meal, an acknowledgement of where food comes from, the sense of the Yovel, the 50-year Jubilee, and the Shemitah, the 7-year Leaving Fields Fallow. Judaism has lots of these references through the what we call the Jewish Bible. But again, it's now going to come down to the feeling realm, and what does that mean in terms of the actions and feelings that I then put into place. There's a beautiful teaching by the Rambam, who one of the major scholars in Jewish law, and he says, each action of each person has the capacity to tip the balance between good or bad for ourselves and for the world. And if we reflect on that, there's a very strong imperative that our actions are actually important, rather than feeling our actions are unimportant and we're just kind of on the continuum of whatever someone else is suggesting that we should be doing. And to finish that off, is that Rabbi Tarfon, who was not a hugely great scholar, but he had a bunch of stuff to say, and he said the following, and I'm going to finish with this because I think it gives us a moment. It is not your duty to complete the work, nor is it up to you to finish it. If you were speaking today's language, you'd say, hello, but neither are you free to desist from it. And again, the very strong moral imperative that we actually have a part to play, we are not just along for the ride. Thank you very much for your time.